Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you can check out the events page, because we got events coming up. We're doing events again in 2021. Got the first of those in Bentonville, Arkansas. So come out to the Ozarks in the spring. That is April 16th and 17th. Chad will be there. I'll be there. You want to be there. I mean, you haven't been doing anything all of 2020. You've been locked up. Well, 2021 is the year that you go back out and you start hanging out with people again. Hopefully that's what it is. So all the information is over on the events page. It's $65 for a two-day conference. You don't want to miss it. You can drive there if you're around where Arkansas is. We're a little bit central. We're in the central time zone anyway, so I think that means that a lot of people can drive here. And if not, you can fly in. We got the airport just 15 minutes from the event. No reason not to come and hang out. And then, of course, also we have the general conference in October. You want to register for that before the first of the year, because we are doing the early bird special, which ends January 1. So you want to go ahead and get your ticket for that as soon as you can. Chad, we left off with Jonathan talking some temporary sense into his father. He seemed sane for a moment. Of course, war now is going to break out again.
Yeah, instead of temporary insanity, we're going to have temporary sanity on the part of Saul. But yeah, it won't take very long. It seems like every time there's war and every time David does well, all of a sudden Saul just the switch flips in his head, and he's a crazy spear throwing guy again.
Yeah, well, it seems like the way this sets up, because it's only a couple of verses. You know, you have Jonathan talking sense into Saul, and then it just kind of gives you this sort of short little information where it says there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a great blow, and they fled before him. And you're like, okay, I guess that's nice to know. The reason I think that you're being told that is that this is the trigger that sends Saul back into this state of paranoia. So every time David goes and does well, Saul is not congratulating himself for choosing the right man to command his armies, but it is instead like, this guy, I am really getting sick and tired of his heroics.
Yeah, it's like, this guy does such a great job for Israel. I think we should kill him. That's kind of the irrationality behind Saul's thinking. Yeah, that's what verse 8 sets us up. Yeah, this great battle. David's victorious, kills all these Philistines. Verse 9, they're back home, and Saul's sitting there. He's got his loaded 357 in his lap. He's holding his spear, in other words. David picks up his lyre or his harp. He's strumming along, trying to soothe Saul. And the next thing you know, we have spear throwing going on again. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, and David slips away. He sneaks away from Saul's presence, and the spear lands in the wall once more. And so David flees and escapes. I think I've mentioned before that, you know, Saul really should have been taking some spear throwing lessons, because he seems to be really bad at actually being able to, I mean, like, did he ever actually kill somebody with his spear in battle? Because, I mean, I'm guessing they're in pretty close quarters here. And yeah, he's missed David multiple times. And as we'll hear in chapter 20, he also misses Jonathan. So not very good odds.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that's interesting about this, you know, we see this line over and over again that then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul. And I know we've mentioned that this is obviously different than the spirit of the Lord, but that God has allowed the spirit to come upon Saul. If you think about, like, you know, what is that spirit? And we're not told exactly what it is, but it seems that you can take this away from it. Suspicion, envy, jealousy, these are harmful things. These are not things that are serving the life of Saul well.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I mean, all of that combined, you know, he's got obviously some kind of mental stuff going on, but he also has to struggle with jealousy and fear and envy and this kind of maniacal captivation with David. I don't know how else to put it. It's like he's fascinated with David, but in an entirely unhealthy sort of way. It's like he can't, you know, we always talk about a person living rent-free inside your head. Well, that's definitely what's going on here with Saul. David is living rent-free inside of Saul's head, and he just can't seem to get rid of him. Even though the strange thing is, you know, David is doing none of this on purpose.
Right.
He sets out with no sinister motive. He doesn't want to stage a coup. He's entirely faithful to Saul, even to the point where he's putting himself in obvious danger and wanting to, and he's doing so in order to help the king out. But all of that is for nothing. As we'll hear in chapter 20, he's so frustrated because he's going to tell Jonathan, hey, what have I done? You know, is there something that I'm missing here? Have I sinned in some way that your dad wants to kill me so much? So, you got kudos to David because, I mean, he is kind of an emblem of fidelity at this point in his life because he's putting his own life in danger in order to help the life of his king.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the only thing that Jonathan could tell David is like, you know, we'll go a long way. Maybe go lose a battle.
Yeah. could you stop being so successful?
Yeah, that would go help. A long way.
So anyway, that's that episode. It's pretty short, just three verses. Now, verse 11 and following, 11 through 17, is a different kind of situation. This chapter just keeps getting more interesting as we get along because the last of it's just very bizarre. But this next section is 11 through 17, and there's some connections here with the Book of Psalms and with some earlier episodes that we've covered in the podcast, having to do with Rachel and with Rahab. And then we even have a kind of a flash forward, you might say, to a similar scenario that happens to Paul way, way later in the Book of Acts. So anyway, we'll get to all that. Basically, here's what happens. Saul gives up on trying to pin David to the wall, since that has been repeatedly unsuccessful, and instead decides he's going to use messengers. So he sends this delegation, these spies, I guess we would call them, to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But his wife, Saul's daughter, Michal, she finds out, and she says, if you don't save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be put to death. I suppose there was some, you know, whispering in her father's house, and somehow word gets back to her of what is going to go down in the morning. So what does she do? She let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. So it's pretty interesting because this is not the only time. Well, interesting a couple different ways. First of all, this is not the only time that Michal is connected with a story that has to do with a window. So this particular time, this action of letting David out through the window is a token of her love for him. We've already been told that she loved David. In fact, I think I mentioned that that's the only time explicitly in the Old Testament that we're told a woman loved a man. So she does love David, and she shows that love in action here by saving his life, by letting him down through the window. Now, if you move forward in the David narrative to 2 Samuel chapter 6, David is dancing before the ark. Remember that whole story? He's got the linen ephod on, and you know, he's happy, and he's expressing that happiness in this kind of dance. And we're told in 2 Samuel 6 that Michal, once more, is connected with a window. She looks down from her window, and she sees what David is doing, and she just thinks it's scandalous. And so the next time they're together, she lets David know just how upset she was by his actions. And it's a sad chapter in their marriage because evidently from that day forward, they were not really together. Of course, David had many other wives and women in his life. And so the implication is that from that time forward, there was nothing else really between David and Michal. But that's kind of a narrative thing that's interesting to point out, that both episodes have to do with her and David. Both episodes have to do with the window. One, she expresses her love, and the other, she loses her love, or at least loses this intimacy and marriage that they had up to that point. The other direction this is interesting is because we have other kinds of narratives like this that happen through scriptures. You know, the one that immediately comes to mind is from Joshua, right after the spies arrive and they stay at Rahab's place, and she lets them down through a window in order that they can escape. Same thing happens here. And then I can't think of where it's at. It's I know it's in the Book of Acts, but it's in the midst of one of, you know, Paul's talking about all these crazy scenarios that he finds himself in. And he was in the city of Damascus, and he was let down through a window. and escaped. And that was the way he was able to save his life. So, you know, build practical device. If you ever need to escape, there's always a window.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it is. This, you mentioned Paul going down through a window. It is, and I'm sure as an Old Testament guy, you hear this as well. But whenever I read the account, you know, in Acts, and you hear the son of David say to Saul, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?"
Yes.
I mean, this takes you like right back to this entire narrative, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's got to be intentional. I mean, I don't know any other way that you can read that. The son of David saying, "Saul, Saul." I mean, the name itself is just perfect. "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" You could write that over this whole section of David's life.
Yeah.
It's all foreshadowing what's going to happen. So she lets him. Okay, she lets him out. He gets away. Good, good. But she's now got to deal with the men. So she's going to get pretty sneaky here. She's gonna pick up on the actions of earlier women, both of Rahab as well as Rachel. So she it's not entirely clear what she did, because you can translate the Hebrew a couple different ways. But most of the English versions will say that she took the household idol. I believe is the way that it's the way New American Standard. I think in ESV has the image, I believe. Anyway, yep. She takes the image. This is in Hebrew, it's a teraphim. So if you think back to when Jacob and Rachel and Leah and all their kids, when they fled from Laban to head back to the promised land, that Rachel stole the teraphim that belonged to her father and she hid them under her camel's saddle. Same word that's used here. So you ordinarily, these things were pretty small. They were like little figurines. I'm not exactly sure if this was like a life-size household idol or image, or if something else is going on here. One commentator thought that the image was placed actually not on the bed, but at the bed. That is to say, almost in an attempt to like keep it close to David, as if he were sick in bed. And so the closeness, the intimacy of the idol would somehow benefit him. So, as I say, it's not entirely clear what's going on, but we do have this image, this teraphim that is connected with the bed. And then she does the old, you know, escaped prisoner trick, like Escape from Alcatraz, where she puts a sheet over and then she puts some hair, it's goat hair in this case, up there to make it look like he's laying there all covered up in bed. Then Saul's messengers get there to take David, and she says, "Oh, he's not feeling well. He's sick today." So I guess the messengers go back to see Saul, and Saul finds out. And so he sends these messengers saying, he's sick. All right. Well, bring him up to me on his bed. So, I mean, Saul is determined he's going to kill David, even if he has to basically put him on a cot or a stretcher and bring him up to his house.
Well, he's probably thinking, you know, I mean, he says literally bring him up in the bed that I may kill him. Right. So, So he's thinking, I have not done well with this throwing spears at this guy when he's in good health, but surely I can stab this guy while he's bedridden.
Right. I know I'm not very accurate with my spear, but surely if he's just laying there in bed, I can get him.
There's also something strange about this, that he doesn't just tell them, well, go back down there and kill him.
Yeah. He wants to do it himself.
Yeah. He wants to do it.
Yeah. That is very true. Yeah. This is very personal for Saul. It seems to become increasingly personal. You know, for a while, he would have been content to let the Philistines kill him. But he's way beyond that point. Now he's wanting to make sure that he does the deed himself. So they go into the house, verse 16, and behold, the image, the household idol, was on the bed with a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So they find out the ruse. Then, to make matters worse, Saul berates his daughter. He says to her, "Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And then Michal, still very sly, says to her dad, "Oh, because he told me to let him go. Otherwise, he would put me to death." So she joins the ranks of a whole list of women who got out of a bad situation by means of using their wits. Or were able to get what they wanted by using their wits. We have example after example of that. Everything from Rebecca getting the blessing for her favorite son, or you know, Rachel deceiving her father, Laban, Tamar, deceiving Judah. So in this case, she deceives her own father.
It does seem like maybe this is this gets you out of a bind of having your father. I don't know what. Maybe she thinks her dad's crazy enough to put her to death too, if she doesn't say that, listen, I didn't have a choice here. But if that's not the case, you did just temporarily outwit your father, but you also gave him more fuel because he said, did this guy just threaten to kill my daughter? This seems like long term. This is just added fuel to the fire.
Right. Yeah. The after effects of this will not be good. It's just going to make things worse between Saul and David. So I think this particular scenario is connected with these earlier episodes. I mean, you've got all kinds of parallels here between Rachel and Laban. You know, they both deceive their father. They both have the terebinth. They're covered up by clothes. So I think narratives like this are easy to kind of fit into that mold that we see earlier with stories such as Rachel and her dad. And of course, there's, you know, connections here with Joshua as well, with how Rahab was able to save the spies through deception and through letting them down through the window. So we got this intertextuality going on here with these earlier narratives. And I'll add this too. This is the first time that we've been able to do this. So we'll talk about it for a second. If you go to the book of Psalms and you look at the titles or the introductions, you might call them, to many of the Psalms, beginning, I think, with Psalm 3, many of these that are written by David are connected with events in his life. So you'll have a psalm by David and then a description of something that was happening in his life that was reflected in the psalm or was the occasion on which the psalm was written. And there's a whole list of these. But I think this is the first one of these that we have encountered so far. So if you look at Psalm 59, this is the introduction to the psalm. It says it's a miktam, a kind of psalm of David. When Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. So I find this fascinating. What I like to do when I'm working through the Psalms, anytime that there is a heading like that points me back to a specific event in the life of Saul, it's interesting to read the Psalm with that event in mind and to see how they compare and in some cases how they contrast or how the Psalm might reflect that particular situation, but will actually take it in a totally different direction. So Psalm 59 does that. We're not going to spend much time looking at it, but it starts out, for instance, deliver me from my enemies, O my God, set me securely on high away from those who rise up against me. And then it gets pretty specific. It talks about how his enemies, at evening, it says they howl like a dog and they go around the city. So it's, you know, David he's at home, and Saul sends these messengers that David depicts as these dog-like characters. They're going around the city. You can kind of picture them like they're sniffing David out. It says they're howling like dogs as they go around the city. Okay, well, you can see how Psalm 59 would certainly kind of reflect what's happening here. And David even says earlier, he says that these fierce men are attacking him, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord, for no guilt of mine they run and set themselves against me. That, again, reflects what's happening here in 1 Samuel. But what David does in the psalm, and this is the same thing he does in other psalms as well, is he takes this specific experience in his life and he sort of universalizes it, because he goes on to talk about all the nations in Psalm 59. So how all the nations are attacking God's people, or they're antithetical to the ways of God. So David takes his own specific experience, and then he amplifies that to where what's happening with him and his prayer to God during this particular time actually applies to all other kinds of situations. And so he basically he'll nationalize his individual experience which I think is a pretty cool thing about the Psalms themselves. Of course, the Psalms, many of them are written by a specific person, maybe arising out of a specific situation, but they're meant to be prayers of everyone. And so we can see ourselves in these same kind of situations, or a prayer of the church, where what's happening to the people of God is reflected in the Psalm as well. We'll come across more of these as we go through the life of David. As I said, I think this is the very first one of these, Psalm 59, but you can check that on your own and compare what David says there with what's happening here with Saul's men circling his house and waiting to take him out in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to remember that the Psalms, particularly of David, that they are, you can match the vast majority of them up with events in David's life, right? So it really does sort of bring the Psalm out of black and white and into color. Okay, if you match this story up with this Psalm, now you can see exactly what he's talking about here. Otherwise, when you read him, it just sounds like some sort of like really obscure poetry, right?
Yeah, right. Another thing that is a lot of fun to do, I did this, the book I just finished, The Christ Key, one of my chapters is about Christ in the Psalms. And one of the things I did in that chapter is, so what you'll take a psalm, we'll say Psalm 41 or 42 or something like that. So a psalm that is quoted in the New Testament on the lips of Jesus or in reference to Jesus, all right? So you take that, and then you go back to the psalm, and you realize, okay, so this psalm is not just about what's happening to David, but it's also what's happening to Jesus, right? So you line these up. Okay, so what happens to David also happens to the son of David, or you might even say that what's going to happen to the son of David in some way influences what happens to David himself. It's kind of a backward effect. But either way, you're reading David's life and you're reading the life of Christ side by side. Then, in the psalm itself. But then what you can do is take a further step, and then you go back to a narrative in David's life that the psalm is based off of, and you see how the narrative itself also is pointing forward to what's going to happen to Christ himself. In other words, it's instructive with regard to how we should interpret the scriptures is what I'm saying. So you can see how the psalm is quoted in reference to Jesus. Then you read Jesus and David side by side in the psalm. But then also you take it that one step back to the narrative itself. And you say, oh, okay, so what's happening to David here is providing us with the blueprint for what's going to happen to the son of David. And the psalms bring that, all of that together into a prayer. So it all fits together.
Yeah. You ever think about how David being the most explicit foreshadowing of Christ, I think that we've said that before, that it's not, I don't even know if it's close, right?
So David, I don't think anybody else is even close,
right? Yeah, so David being that, this is a hard calling.
Yeah. Right, yeah, how'd you like that job?
I mean, because this means that you are going to be a man of sorrows, that you are going to suffer, that you are going to be hated, that you're going to be mistreated. I mean, this is, as you read the life of David, knowing that that's who he is, that ultimately what David is this foreshadowing of the son of David. This is a rough calling for God to give you.
Yeah. You know that you're going to have a long Good Friday if you're David. Which is really the way that First Samuel should be read. This is you have the anointing, you have this secret anointing, and then, except for a very brief period, when like the slaying of Goliath, when things go well, after that, pretty much it's a Saul, why do you persecute me kind of situation.
Yeah, well, you're going to have with David, of course, like the victory over God's enemies in a way that maybe nobody else has. I mean, this is why the people of Israel are so adamant that they want a second David, right? I mean, the Messiah that they want is they want David 2.0, right? Because mm-hmm. nobody has more victories against the enemies of God than David does. But also, nobody suffers the way that David suffers. And so this is very much how Christ is, that, of course, he is the ultimate champion over everything that would enslave the people of God. But he is the champion through much suffering and turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, suffering, not just Good Friday kind of suffering, of course, but suffering from the lies, you know, the plots of people against him. No doubt there's so much, of course, that's not recorded in the Gospels, but it seems as if he was the ongoing attack, the ongoing target of verbal attacks on the part of his adversaries throughout his ministry. And you see that reflected again in the Psalms, because David talks over and over about his enemies, and they sharpen their tongue like a serpent, poison of a viper is on their lips. He'll talk about how, you know, their speech was smoother than butter, but their heart was war. So you can imagine all these people, you know, maybe saying one thing to David's face and saying something else behind his back. And we have that same thing reflected in the Gospels. You know, people will try and trap Jesus in his words. They'll ask him a question as if they're seeking information or they want to learn more, but really all they're doing is wanting to try and get him to say something they'll be able to use against him.
Yeah, this is especially rough for David because Jesus does have the advantage of being God. So so he's not going to have his own sin to contend with. Instead, he contends with all of our sin, which is a monumental task, obviously. But David is out here as this sort of representative of what Christ will be like, but he is also a sinner. So this is a very rough road.
Very rough road. Yeah. Well, we've seen some of that already. We'll see. We see now what happens next. This next episode is very weird. It's another Samuel episode. We don't hear a whole lot about Samuel. We haven't heard much about him the last few episodes, but he's going to pop up here again because David's going to go running to him, probably for help and for advice. So David runs away, he escapes, and he goes to Ramah, where Samuel lives, and he told him all that Saul had done to him. So I don't know how much Samuel was privy to all the events that have been transpiring, but I'm sure David gave him an earful about everything that Saul had been doing. So he and Samuel leave, and they go to a place called Naioth. We don't know for sure where that is, probably pretty close to Ramah. Maybe it was a little settlement right outside of Ramah. Evidently, there's a whole group of prophets that hang out with Samuel. So maybe this is a little, I don't know what we'd call it, prophetic village setting. Whatever it is, it's close to Ramah, called Naioth. So Saul finds out. He's evidently got, you know, ears to the ground all over the place, because it seems like David can't do anything without Saul finding out about it. So he finds out where he's at. And so once more, he's going to send messengers to take David, just like he sent him to his house. So verse 20 says, Saul sent these messengers to take David, but when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing and presiding over them, the Spirit of the Lord came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And we'll come back to that in a second. What happens next? Well, Saul finds out, and so what does he do? He sends other messengers. And what happened to those messengers? Same thing. They also prophesied. So we have this predictable pattern. What do you do when something doesn't work twice? You try it three times. Third time's a charm. So he sent messengers a third time. And guess what? They also prophesied.
I think this is the sense of humor that God has coming through here, where Saul's like, go get him. And so you send these guys that are going ready to, you know, it seems like sort of like arrest David, essentially, right? And nope, like, we're all going to start prophesying. What?
Right.
You do this three times. Does he just have all these guys that are showing up to take you back to Saul, and they're just all prophesying? unwillingly. They're not there to do that. They just get overtaken by the Spirit of God, and they're just all prophesying. Probably like, I wish we had these prophecies all recorded. Probably prophesying about the greatness of David or something crazy.
Probably so. Yeah. It's like you send, you know, police officers to church to arrest a preacher. They get there and they all just start preaching. Things do not go well. Saul cannot get his way, have his way, no matter what. Well, again, according to the predictable pattern, if something happens three times and it doesn't work, well, the fourth time, you try something different. So verse 22, Saul, probably disgusted at this point, was like, I guess I have to do it myself. So he goes to Ramah. He came as far as the large well that's in Seku, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? Now, let me pause for a second, because this ought to sound familiar to us. In fact, it's specifically designed to sound familiar to us, because we have a repeat here of what happened the very first chapter where we were introduced to Saul. Remember that he was looking for his father's donkeys. His friend says, hey, why don't we go check the prophet? The prophet, he's going to know. And so they go to where the prophet lives, to Ramah. And they ask, where is the prophet? Saul asks, where is the prophet? All of this is kind of bookending the life of Saul. So we're introduced to him, and he is anointed king. And then Samuel says to him, you know, one of the signs that you're going to have is you're going to meet a bunch of prophets, and you're going to start prophesying, right? Remember all that from a few episodes ago. So kind of keep that in mind, because what's about to happen now? Well, he goes to Ramah. He says, hey, where's Samuel and David? And somebody says, well, they're in Naioth in Ramah. So he heads out of town to this little prophetic village. He gets there, and what happens to him? The Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And now things really get strange, because it says that he stripped all his clothes off, and he prophesied before Samuel, and he laid down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, this little proverb that we've heard before, is Saul also among the prophets? Now, I think what's happening here is that if we didn't already have it figured out that things are completely over for Saul, this ought to remove all doubt. Because even the actions themselves are indicative of what's happening. He's been clothed with the Spirit of God before. He's become king, and now he's unclothed. He's stripped there. He's laying naked. He had opposed Samuel. Now he's just on the ground. He's literally lying on the ground, naked, prophesying. And it seems to me that this is kind of the lowest point for Saul. He's had his kingship stripped away. Literally, his clothes are stripped away. He's now subjecting himself before Samuel, laying there on the ground, and he's prophesying, meaning that everything that he's doing is indicative of the fact that he is no longer in control of himself. He's no longer able to serve as king. He's no longer able to fulfill his will. Instead, he's basically lost everything at this point.
It seems like God is sending Saul a pretty clear message that he won't altogether receive accurately. That whatever it is that he's got planned for David is just simply not going to work. And that Saul has this very personal reminder that God is ultimately in control of all this. And if God does not want him to kill David, then he's simply not going to be able to. Yeah. This is not a choice that you get to make. We talk about how bad is Saul at throwing a spear. Well, everyone's bad at throwing a spear when God doesn't want the spear to hit whatever you're throwing it at.
Yeah,
that's very true. This is how this works, and you're not going to be able to kill this guy if God does not mean for this man to be killed by you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like a lot of situations. Looking at it from the outside, it should be obvious to anybody that everything that you've just said is true. I mean, it just There's no way to misunderstand that.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're Saul, you would think you have to leave this situation, saying this is over.
Right, right.
I have to end this pursuit of eliminating David.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, to anybody else, it would be obvious, and you would think it'd be obvious to Saul, but once more, he doesn't see it. He's blinded by his own envy. He's blinded by his own jealousy. Blinded by all the things that we've been talking about. You know, I think probably all of us have encountered somewhat analogous situations. You know, well, maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a friend, just somebody, you know, we know pretty well. And maybe we're even like talking to them and like, you know, you can't go down that road. You know what's going to happen. We try and talk sense into them. We try and present them with, you know, the kind of evidence that is just inescapable. So it's obvious to us that this is not going to work. And yet, what do? They end up doing the very thing that we have counseled them not to do. So that's why I say it's easy from the outside to see what's going on here. But when you're stuck inside, some sin or kind of a spiritual addiction of sorts, an addiction to some sort of evil, then it's easy to convince yourself against all evidence that you should continue walking down that bad road, which of course is exactly what Saul is going to do.
Yeah. And it is sort of tragic because, of course God is willing, not just willing, of course God is desires that all repent, right? Mm-hmm. That all be saved, that all find forgiveness, all of these things. And here, I mean, the window is not closed for Saul. I mean, this could be a very different story if Saul takes this obvious message from God that that you are not going to achieve what it is that you are setting out to achieve, and repented, and asked God to. I mean, at no point do we read that Saul cries out to God to take away this tormenting spirit, repent for his suspicion and hatred and evil thoughts regarding David. You can have a very different story here if you embrace the good work of repentance. But Saul is not going to do that, and that's sort of and this does seem like one of the sort of like maybe the last one of the last opportunities for him to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe a couple times in the future, the door is slightly open, but I think really this is one of those last times.
Yeah, well, he's there. The people are prophesying. He's there in Samuel's hometown. This seems like a good spot to get everything straightened out.
Yeah, and because of all that, I really do think this is intentionally framed in order to be kind of that last real chance that Saul has, because he's back with the very same guy that anointed him as king. He's back in the very same place where he was anointed as king. He's prophesying again, just like happened to him immediately after he was anointed as king. So his life, at least his adult life, has come full circle back to where it all began when we met him. So what we're going to see as the story goes on is just kind of more the unraveling of his life. The next chapter is also a significant chapter because it's the one where we kind of say goodbye to Jonathan. Jonathan has figured, you know, fairly prominently in the story so far. He was a war hero earlier on, and he's a very good, not just good friend of David, but an ally of David. But at the end of chapter 20, Jonathan is basically going to say goodbye to David, and he's going to fade from the scene. So I think just structurally in 1 Samuel, what we see happening as these last two stories, well, the one we talked about now and the one we're going to talk about next week, is the storyteller is narrowing the focus more and more to just David. So Saul's going to fade from the scene pretty soon. Jonathan is fading from the scene very soon. And before we know it, the entire focus is going to be just on David. So that's the direction that we're going.
All right. Well, that is it. We will get into the next chapter next week. Guys, make sure you go over to the events page, sign up for all the events. And Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.